My name is Michael Crumplin. I'm a retired general surgeon and I'm an honorary curator at the Royal College of Surgeons of England. And my interest is in 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th and 20th century history and evolution of surgery. Really, what we need to do when we think of surgical management, and it's important before getting onto that, that we understand that more people are killed by disease and climate and accident than of surgical wounding in battle. But surgical injury has been always present, and in prehistorical times, wounds such as lacerations, bruising, penetrating injuries or cutting injuries were probably treated by tribal members who showed some care and expertise in dressing wounds and extracting foreign bodies and so forth. And in fact, the operation of trepanation, or making a hole in the skull to let out evil processes, has been recorded as far back as 10,000 years before Christ. But really, things were on complete hold until the Greco-Roman period, as far as European history of medicine and surgery is concerned. One should remember, perhaps, there have been great contributions by Arabic, Chinese, Egyptian, Indian, and other cultures towards medicine. But of course, the problem is that if a good idea was generated thousands or hundreds of years ago, promulgation of the ideas and concepts was difficult without printing, television, the radio, and journals, for example. So isolated examples of surgical brilliance were not uncommon, but remained often in the province of that area. If we get to the Greco-Roman period, everybody, I suppose, knows about Aristotle and Hippocrates, who was born on Kos, and their influence on Roman medicine, people like Celsus and Galen, who was born in Pergamum. And these people had great ideas in terms of public health and hygiene, and also primitive surgery, which of course was very limited. Certainly one of the biggest influences at this time, particularly by Hippocrates, was that of the humours of the body: black bile, yellow bile, blood, and phlegm, indicating respectively melancholic, choleric, sanguine, and phlegmatic characters. And Aristotle also reciprocated with the concept of wet, dry, cold, and heat. And it was thought to be for centuries that the imbalance of these so-called humours led to many illnesses and fatalities. But again, at this time, battle injuries, because warfare accelerates surgery, if nothing else, were fairly simple injuries caused by blunt, piercing, or cutting weapons. Then, after the Greco-Roman period and the fall of the Roman Empire, things went into a decline. The teaching of anatomy, the evolution of surgery, stuttered rather to a halt, until the early Renaissance in the 14th century, when certainly figures in France, such as Guy de Chauillac and Lanfranc, who had produced impressive surgical works, and John of Arderne in Britain too. Going into the 15th century, we're entering into the time when warfare was fairly common and constant. And in fact, the earliest use of gunpowder occurred in about 1340, and this brought about a great change in injury on the battlefield. Still, it is necessary to say that most men were dying of diseases such as smallpox, scarlet fever, influenza, venereal disease later, than battle injury. And as the Renaissance moved on, the 16th century, we have Vesalius, born in Brussels, with his great work on anatomy. And surgeons were beginning to evolve, particularly in the military. The name of Ambroise Paré, an itinerant French surgeon, comes to mind. Here we have a man who not only despises, through discovery, the use of cautery and boiling oil and hot irons to seal bleeding, but a man who learns how to control bleeding by ligaturing of arteries, a very basic procedure. Also, we have William Clowes, a great naval surgeon of the time, who wrote prolifically on wounds and burns and injuries in the Navy. And at the same time, we have the creation by Henry VIII in 1540 of the Company of Barber Surgeons, where barbers and surgeons were united by a common charter. Leaving the Renaissance now, and the 16th century, we pass on to the 17th century, where Harvey's great discovery of circulation of the blood in 1628 proved to be of great value to surgeons and the understanding of bleeding and its control. Richard Wiseman and Sydenham were two great clinicians of the English Civil War. Wiseman was a surgeon on the Royalist side. He backed the wrong side, unfortunately, but was a very wise naval and military surgeon who believed in audits and second opinions and advising surgeons of their mistakes and how to avoid them. And Sydenham was a great physician and diagnostician of the time. Woodall was another naval surgeon following in Clowes's footsteps. He invented a special trephine for taking small discs of the skull out to prevent bleeding and ameliorate injury. And also a surgeon called Young invented, or was the first to do, a flap operation. Instead of just when you amputate a limb, cutting straight through it like a round of beef, he actually designed flaps to be formed to cover the bone end, which often protruded after the former operation. At the end of the 17th century, we enter into the Age of Enlightenment, running over the 18th century, and certainly there was some enlightenment within medicine. The first great discovery, although it wasn't recognised and didn't mature for over 50 years, was the small, simple control trial by Lind, the famous naval surgeon, on HMS Salisbury, to prove that oranges and lemons containing vitamin C prevented scurvy. And it wasn't till the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805 that scurvy had been pretty well eradicated from the Navy. And we see it disappearing, cases of scurvy disappearing from naval hospitals at that time. Also, John Pringle was a famous Director General of the Army Medical Department, and he was known as the first father of English military medicine. And he was very keen on public health manoeuvres, study of climatic disease, the avoidance of overcrowding, and the understanding of the spread of tetanus, otherwise known as jail fever. And he quite understood that this was due to overcrowding and poor hygiene. Variolation, which was practiced by Lady Montagu Wortley, was a practice of extracting small amounts of fluid from cases of smallpox who were not suffering from the severe type of the disease, variola major, and inoculating these into at-risk patients. And this was practiced during the Seven Years' War, but obviously one of John Hunter's pupils, and we'll hear more of Hunter in a minute, was Edward Jenner, a general practitioner from Gloucestershire, who practiced vaccination by taking small amounts of cowpox blister fluid and injecting them into children. And he practiced this gratis. This was widely adopted, this practice, in Britain and in France. So that really by about 1806, most of the soldiers in the British Army and the sailors in the Royal Navy were protected. So we see that scurvy and smallpox disappearing from admissions to hospital. But the story leads on to the Hunter brothers. John and William Hunter were born in East Kilbride and near East Kilbride, and they moved south to England, William to become a notable obstetrician at the Middlesex Hospital, a man midwife really, and also a great anatomist. And his younger brother John followed him down later to London and helped him with dissections and teaching. And eventually John became the better known of the two and practiced surgery. He held classes in the famous Windmill School of Anatomy with his brother, and they there rehearsed not only anatomical dissection, but also they practiced surgery. And John Hunter, in fact, became Director General of the Army Medical Department in 1793 when he died. And his primitive experience in military surgery was not particularly outstanding. But he did bring in some very good organisational issues into the British Army, such as all physicians should serve as a house surgeon for a short while, all junior doctors should go through hospital training before they go out into regiments or practice in general. So we enter now into the late part of the 18th century and the beginning of the wars against Republican France and Napoleonic France.